On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, I'd like to welcome Linda Rossetti onto the show. Linda Rossetti is a woman who just had a book published called Dancing with Disruption. She has dedicated her life to changing how the world thinks about disruption. The book is about transforming our understanding of the isolation and uncertainty that's tied to major change and guides us through a proven toolkit that can ensure our success. Readers learn to reframe emotions, restore confidence, and realize possibilities once thought unimaginable. Hope you enjoy this episode with Linda Rossetti on the Fear Me Out podcast. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of interviewing Linda Rossetti. Her publicist actually contacted me, I think that's correct, to ask me if I would consider interviewing her. She just wrote a book that was published in this year, 2023, right? It's called Dancing with Disruption. And I was looking at your website and found what you were writing about and your own life very interesting. So Linda, welcome. Tell us a bit about who you are.
Dana, thank you for having me. It's nice to be here. And sure, I can tell you a little bit. You know, I am somebody who is crazy enough to believe that I can change the world. And there's a topic, right? There's a topic that just has like captured my curiosity. And it's this notion of how we respond to moments of disruption in our lives. And through my own experience and the experience of loads of other people that I've dealt with through my work, I've realized that so often we stall or disengage or retreat at those moments, when in fact, I think there's signals for us to reach for more. And so who I am is somebody who is trying to educate and engage and generally talk to those who are willing to think differently about these very common experiences in our lives and invite them to think differently. And so I come to this having had a long career doing lots of related things, but mostly, you know, I found this topic after a period of great pain in my own life. And so it's an absolute joy to do what I do. And as you mentioned, I have a book called Dancing with Disruption. And I get to do this all day long. I talk to folks and it's a great pleasure.
Cool. So tell us a little bit about where you grew up and what things were like for you as a child, if you don't mind.
Sure. I'm a native New Englander. I grew up outside of Boston, Massachusetts. I have a sister and I have, probably the best memory of that is I had 12 years of parochial school, which sounds probably a little silly to mention. And it isn't because I had some horrendous experience. What I remember distinctly was being in the company of very powerful women who controlled and had all the leadership positions there were to have. And it was fascinating to me. And I have this very vivid image on Fridays, you know, the priest would come by and visit the kids and the, you know, gentlemen, they're all men, would walk into the back of the room and the nun would like whisper in their ear and tell them what to say, you know, basically feed them a line, and they would walk up to the front of the room and voila, there we go. And so, you know, I think that probably started my track in being very interested in being a female leader. And that has been something that's been important to me for nearly 40 years. I've worked in a variety of environments in kind of conventional corporate roles. And I've had the great good fortune of being in executive positions in many environments. And even so, I'm somebody who still shakes my head that somehow we as a society haven't figured out how to engage everyone. and everyone's voice. You know, we have an awful lot of normative behaviors that still prefer a single voice. It oftentimes happens to be white males. I find that to be a real tragedy. And, you know, so that theme, you know, probably started young, you know, with the sisters, and has blossomed ever since. And I also, it's probably relevant to note that I'm a child of two scientists, right? My dad and mom both had science degrees, and maybe that theme of possibility was kind of set early.
You know, if I can interrupt just for a sec, I really love the idea that you had a positive experience in a parochial school, because as a therapist, mostly I hear the other side of the coin.
Of course, right there. And I don't want to say it was 100% positive, right? Let's just be honest. And but I do, there are things that stick with us. And I think that, you know, there was an uncomfortable hierarchy that existed in those environments. And yet there was kind of a fascination that, in fact, the real power was outside of that hierarchy. And to me, that was really kind of a point of interest. And it's gotten me to go even further. And I should say I'm no longer somebody who practices the Catholic faith, even though, you know, my birth family would love that. You know, somebody who's believed in female leadership and empowerment, it's hard to kind of stay in that world. And so I've gone beyond it, but it was an interesting experience, an interesting formative experience.
Yeah. So what was it like growing up with two scientists?
Oh, wow. Well, you know, it's interesting. I don't know. I guess that's my normal. So I'm not sure what that means, right? I don't know, have anything to compare it to. You know, my dad was somebody who, you know, was a bench scientist at heart. He had, you know, a number of patents, and he loved to tinker with things. You know, whereas my mother was much more of an educator. She taught at the college level. And so, you know, I don't know what it was like. It was, it was just our house.
Well, I'm imagining that they instilled a sense of curiosity, I'm hoping, in you.
Probably.
Yeah, you seem like a very curious person to me, like the world is of interest to you. And I think
I think that is a very fair statement, Dana.
Yeah. And I think that can come out of growing up with people that are interested in what's happening in the world, or at least in their part of the world.
No question.
My kids grew up with a dad who was a psychologist and a mom who was a hospice nurse. So a lot of dinner time conversations are about me helping people live and my wife helping people die. So, That was their norm, which I know was not
anyone's.
So
still, you know, both very powerful experiences. What a nice thing to share with your children.
Yeah. Tell us a bit more about emotionally what things were like growing up in your family, if you don't mind.
Sure. You know, I had an older sister who, you know, she was, you know, all the rage. And I think that's something that was very powerful in my house as well, right? You know, my sister was gorgeous, physically gorgeous. She, you know, she was very involved in our community. And I think that being her younger sister was always the thing that I think was the trickiest emotional thing. Yeah. You know, and I think that for me, I excelled academically, right? And I don't want to say in an effortless way, but I think that it was, I didn't have to try so hard to do that. And I think that I remember at times, you know, my parents saying, well, don't make your sister feel bad, you know, because it's so easy for you to, you know, be terrific in academics. And I kind of used to look at them like, what do you mean? Like, she's got it easy in so many other spheres. Right. And so I think that's the biggest emotional kind of catalyst, is this notion of what does it mean to be, you know, able to honor the things you're able to do and use those in a way that are, you know, present in a way that aligns with who you are, right? So this notion of saying, don't make your sister feel bad about an academic issue, you know, that's, I think, something that is now I see in my work many, many decades later. You know, most of my work is really an invitation to make sure others are seen, right? That they their voice and who they are. And when I say voice, I don't mean audibly them speaking. I mean, their essence of their truth is really this call to turning up the volume on our own voices. And I think that probably those experiences of don't make your sister feel bad, probably had its roots, you know, in this interest of mine of being seen, because it is so much a part of the work that I do now is about helping people reframe their experiences of disruption in their lives and to recognize that there's an opportunity for growth, which really just means this opportunity to get closer to who we are and being willing to live within in alignment with that. And so I think that, you know, emotionally, you know, that all probably has its roots in that relationship.
Sure. Just to be super clear with my listeners, what is your definition of a disruption in one's life?
Sure. And I thank you for asking me because, you know, I think all of us, if we gave ourselves 5 minutes, we can come up with a list of zillions of disruptions, right? Everything from, the gas station attendant not helping out when we needed it, so we're late for work, or, you know, something more catastrophic, you know, that, you know, perhaps we have an illness that comes up, or there's a loss in our family, or we've lost a job, right? So the disruptions that I'm mostly interested in my work are those that involve a shift in our thinking about our self-concept, right? Those are the disruptions that I'm really interested in. And very often they involve this thinking about, you know, who am I, right? You know, a recognition that there's something changing. Like I remember one woman just recently I talked with, and she had a wonderful way to put it. She said, you know, I feel as if I've lost myself, you know, so there's some break in the connection to their thinking about who they are. And, or there's a functioning issue, right? That, you know, for whatever reason, their baseline functioning is no longer, they're no longer able to operate at that level. So the disruptions that I'm mostly interested in are those that really fall under those umbrellas, right? Where there's a sense of, you know, our identity or our self-concept being somehow, you know, disrupted in some way or interrupted in some way. And that's really the disruption that I think about in my work.
So Linda, I as a psychologist and a curious person myself, I kind of I've come to the conclusion that most of us go in the directions that we do based on things that are really meaningful to us, not just intellectually, but on a deep emotional level. So when I read about the nature of your book and what it's all about, I wonder what kind of disruption that this woman has had to come to terms with that would take her in such a passionate direction.
Well, and I think there are loads, but I'll tell you the one that started it, and then maybe we can look at why that's meaningful based on my other experience. You know, about a decade ago, I was acting at an executive level at a very large global corporation, right? It was, the name of the company was Iron Mountain. You know, many of your brethren in the healthcare arena know Iron Mountain because they used to go along and correct records, right? They used to be the physical records keeper of a lot of people in the healthcare industry, right? They did that for many years. But I remember, you know, I was a direct report to the CEO. You know, we had did business in 37 countries around the world. I had responsibility for 21,000 people, right? It was a massive job. And it had come, you know, I had been working to get a seat at that table, that executive table, for a quarter of a century, right? I had progressive roles in all sorts of places, you know, to get myself not only to, you know, reporting to the CEO, but someday being the CEO. And, you know, my background includes, you know, a graduate degree that includes a Harvard Business School, you know, an MBA from Harvard, right? So this has been tracking. And I remember the reason why it's interesting, perhaps for your listeners, is that I remember sitting in that meeting, right? There was an all day long staff meeting with the CEO and all of his other direct reports. And we were talking about, you know, meaningful topics to the corporation. And I remember saying to myself in that meeting, like, you have got to be kidding me. I worked this hard for this, like, right, for this. Like, you know, I don't remember the exact thing that we were talking about on the agenda, but, you know, we were in this, you know, day long meetings. We had those, you know, every month or whatever. And I was struck with that, like, I have worked this hard because I have worked nearly every waking moment to get an opportunity to be at this place. And I'm sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, it just doesn't it has a break in meaning for me. It doesn't hold the meaning that I expected. And that was a point of absolute instability for me, right? Because I really didn't know how to place that experience in a broader context. Right? I had no idea. My first reaction was, my goodness, there must be something wrong with me. You know, what's the matter? And I think that that was one of the initial kind of initiating circumstances that led me into this path of exploring what it was that was happening to me that I lacked the vocabulary to describe to myself, let alone others. Because when I told people, like, well, you know, I'm kind of not in this place, like I'm not sure what's going on, but there's something wrong. And people looked at me askance, like, are you out of your mind, Linda? Just like, go get another job if you don't like the job, but you are just, what are you doing? You know, and so I think that, you know, that moment to me was very meaningful because I became aware of this break, and it was enough that it got my attention in a very serious way.
And so looking back, are you clear now about what it was that was troublesome to you in that environment and in that situation?
You know, I'm not sure that I am. I've certainly done a lot of work to explore it, but I am fascinated by what I did next, right? Uh-huh. Because what I did next was something that I learned, I think, at a very young age, right? When in, and maybe it was in my science-based household, right? When I got to places where I hit a wall or didn't understand, I drew people to me to help me find the answer. And so when I was at this point, I turned to a gentleman who I had known for a long time and I said, you know, I can't be the only one in this situation. Like, I just can't, right? I admittedly have no idea what's the matter with me. I have absolutely no words to describe it, but I can't be the first one on the planet to have done this. And I said, you know, I really want to do some research. And he looked at me and he just happened to be the head of a national outplacement firm. And for your listeners who may not know what that means, an outplacement firm is kind of a service business that partners with big corporations when they outsource lots of people, right? So if, you know, GE or, you know, I don't know, Google is going to downsize a couple thousand people, they contract with an outplacement firm, and that firm kind of catches those thousand people, works with them to do resumes, helps them kind of get to their next place. And they do that for a fee. And so this gentleman happened to run this outplacement firm. And he said, Linda, let us be your learning lab. And I was like, ooh, I like that. And so my friend Ralph, who ultimately, you know, was gracious enough to let me begin, gave me this platform where it became easy for me to draw others to me and help me kind of interrogate what was happening. But I was doing it through their stories, not my own. And the thing that was really fascinating, Dana, was that as I listened, I heard patterns to what they were saying. And it didn't matter what their circumstances were. Like, it didn't matter if they had a, you know, a personal issue that brought them to the moment of a shift, or if they had, you know, an occupational issue or health issue. Like, it really didn't matter. If you kind of aggregated enough, you could see similar patterns. And I, you know, again, have this memory of listening, saying, why is no one talking about this, right? Why is it that we're ignoring this? And so, you know, maybe that piqued my curiosity that much more, but ultimately that is what began what has been now a decade of very formal research and partnering with some universities to do kind of studies as to what is really happening when we encounter disruption and how we respond to it. And so I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but, you know, ultimately I did recognize that so much of my energy I derive from others, right? And when I'm in an unstable place, I pull others towards me. And I did that in a grand way in the last decade, which has now brought me to this place where I have two books to my name, and I get to talk to a lot of people, right? I mean, a big part of my work is I work through a consultancy where I train coaches and others who are in service businesses supporting others. We train them on methods on how to support people through transformation. And yeah, so that's kind of how that moment got me to a new place. And I credit others, really, the proximity of others and their willingness to talk with me for kind of getting me here.
Did you leave that job right away or did you stay for a while?
It's interesting you say that. It took me almost a year to get out of that job. And it sounds funny to say that in hindsight, but it's difficult, you know, when you're involved in a large organization, you can't just kind of put the keys on the table and walk out the door. It took me a while to negotiate kind of my exit and to talk with my boss about how that was all going to happen. So it took about a year.
And where did you get the courage? Because again, most people I know that face situations like this spend more than a year rationalizing why they shouldn't make a major life change because it's so scary and you know the pain that you know in a certain way is potentially much worse than the pain that you don't know.
No question, right? And I think that ultimately another pain that's bigger has to replace it, right? And I think that the catalyst that probably got me to go, wait, let me paint the picture before I give you that answer. To operate at the level that I was in the organization was one of the most intensely demanding roles I've ever had, right? Right. I mean, I'm sure you've talked with many, I know you've talked with many people on your program who are in intensely demanding roles. And, you know, I remember I had two young children, elementary age children at the time, and a spouse who was an entrepreneur in his own right, doing another job. And, you know, and I thankfully had Mary Poppins as a nanny, but there were some weeks where I paid my nanny 70 hours, right? Yeah. You know, legitimately, right? So I was operating at a point of depletion that was really, I didn't recognize how exhausted I was. And I think that I was truly emotionally unavailable for my children for a long period of time because I was just functioning. I was barely functioning in the role. And ultimately, I remember to answer your question, I remember we went away for a vacation. And I had talked with my husband. This is after the meeting, the boss's staff meeting, like, what am I doing here? And I talked, it's like, you know, I'm going to leave. He's like, yeah, go ahead, you know, whenever. And it was never the point where I was like, okay, keys on the table, I'm out the door. But we went on this vacation and it was the kids, you know, the two kids and my husband and I. And one of the neighbors said to me, what's wrong with one of my children? And I was like, wow, what is she describing? And I think that I observed in that question that my kids, because of my lack of emotional availability, were finding ways to draw inward themselves to get safe. And as soon as I saw that, I went, the first day we got back from vacation, I resigned. Okay. Right. So it was really that kind of question out of nowhere of the neighbor, like, you know, what's wrong, you know, with your child. And I was like, whoa, it like popped me into a new seeing. And yeah. I saw the situation in a very different way. And there was no question. Now, even when I resigned, it still took me 4 months to get out of the job. But but that's, you know, again, welcome to the real world. But the decision was made. And I think what's interesting, though, that your listeners might find interesting is when I did ultimately leave, my body like shut down, right? It physically kind of like I got this very strange virus that no one could figure out what it was other than my OBGYN. And she's like, wow, that's something we only see in pregnant women and, you know, these parts of the world. You know, I got this very unusual virus. And I really think it was my body like really trying to shut down and reset from that very demanding experience. Mm-hmm. And so it really took me more than, you know, I'd like to admit, to kind of get to a place where I could then begin. And thankfully, you know, my colleague and friend in the outplacement business helped me do that.
And do you feel like you were able to make amends to your kids for not being as available as you would have hoped?
No question. I've really spent a lot of time making sure that happens. And, you know, and the fascinating thing, you know, they were very young when that was all happening. And even though I was away a lot and you know, to me as the mom, I carry that in a heavy way. They really don't remember my absence a lot. They remember the presence of our lovely Mary Poppins. But it isn't, right? It isn't, you know, because, oh, mom, you were away. You know, I mean, let's be honest. I was working at the highest levels in the corporation. I was earning a fine salary, and I was able to have some of the best childcare available, right? And that is a rare thing. And particularly, let's, you know, all honor the fact that post-pandemic, so much of our childcare at every level, every strata of what is available within the childcare industry has been substantially reduced, right? It's not available. And it is a continuing stress for a working parents, not just a mom. And it makes the ability to be the parent we want to be and the professional we want to be enormously difficult.
Sure. So you left that job, and it sounds like you started a new chapter in your life.
I like to say I just built, you know, it was kind of not break, let's go left or right. It was a lovely kind of building a second story onto the house that only had a one story on it. You know, so it was an interesting expansion of the skills that I had kind of, I had developed, right? You know, because it's interesting. I now really think about my research as looking at transformation in adults, whereas I had spent almost 20 years working with transformation in organizations, right? Wow. In that job that I was in, that I left, the last conventional job, one of the things that I was responsible for, my team and I were responsible for, was integrating more than 200 acquisitions into one organization, right? Culturally, one organization. And it is an enormously, for those people who have been involved in these kind of jobs, it is an enormously difficult task to get an organization to behave in a new way, right? And so this concept of transformation was one that I knew viscerally. Right. I had lived it. I had tried to move an organization. I had been in some flavor of organizational transformation for my entire career. So coming to it now as a kind of a student of how it happens to the individual was really quite fascinating because I had a lot to bring to the party.
And did you have moments when you weren't quite sure that you made the right decision?
Oh, of course. Of course, I think that, let's see if I can find a great one. You know, I remember one time I had the great good fortune after my first book came out to do a lot of speaking. And I remember I was speaking at this very, very fancy event in New York City. It was on Fifth Avenue, and this group had taken over this beautiful kind of showroom of this fashion house. And they invited me to come speak to their members. And it was just like this stunning place. And I remember standing on that stage saying, what in the heck am I doing here? Like, what am I doing? You know, so I think that, you know, it's very interesting. And I, and Dana, you know, from your work, right? You know, very often when we're in periods of, you know, of growth in adult life, you know, we look backwards to more stable times as a way to kind of say, oh, wait a minute, you know, let me calibrate the ship. Let me get some ballast here. And it isn't so much a description of, oh, I've made a bad choice, right? We're really just trying to get some stability. And I think that I was happy to have been decently into my research at the time so that I didn't say, oh, I've made a bad choice, let me go back. And to recognize it, to say, wait a minute, that's just this last set of expectations that I was comfortable with. And I know, okay, I see what I'm doing. I'm still moving forward, even though sometimes I want to run for cover. But it is nonetheless something that continues to this day. And I would love to meet the people who are able to not do that. But, you know, I've learned through my work, that as we grow, and this is hard to say to a psychologist, because you can correct me from your deep experience, but, you know, as we grow in the work that I study in and is expressed in my book, it's we're really re-examining the assumptions upon which we anchor our sense of self, you know, what holds value and meaning to us. And in that re-examination, sometimes we let go of certain things. Sometimes we turn up the volume on something we might have tamped down, or sometimes we welcome new And we're constantly recentering as we grow through growth. We're kind of like looking at those assumptions and, you know, chucking some and adding others. And, you know, and so in that recentering process, we often look back to stability and or perceive stability and say, oh, that was a good time. Maybe I shouldn't have done this.
Yeah.
But I find that education, right, educating people about what's going on gives them kind of a new way to experience those thoughts and maybe keep going.
The reason that I started my podcast, or at least one of the reasons, is because I think that fear, which is part of what you're talking about, has gotten a bad name because we think that fear is the problem in our lives. And in my opinion, I think it's how we choose to deal with the things that we encounter that determines the outcome. So part of what you're saying is, yeah, I got scared when I was standing up there. And the most common way that I see that people deal with their fear is by turning it into aggression. And most people don't really understand that they turn their fear into aggression, and they either aggress against themselves by being self-critical, or others, or both. And so the natural thing, if you're standing there feeling scared, is to tell yourself that there's something wrong with you. What am I doing? Why did I do this? Or, you know, as a way of trying to manage the fear. And it's not a very effective tool in fear management, turning it into aggression, because it adds insult to the injury that you're already feeling, which is the fear. So it sounds like maybe not in, on a conscious level, but you realize that the best way to handle fear is by kind of connecting to yourself on a deeper level. And kind of reminding yourself of why you were there in the first place, instead of, you know, going on and on inside your head about the fact that you don't belong there and, you know, all of those sorts of ways that we deal with fear, which is to be rejecting and critical of ourselves. So I'm hoping that what I'm saying is making sense to you when you think about it.
Oh, I love it. And I applaud your work about really asking us how we choose to respond, because a big part of the research that I did and what I found is that we really need to reframe our experience of emotions, be it fear, anxiety, a whole cast of them, shame, you know, you name your favorite one. Because when we do that, we are able to, as you say, we're really able to kind of externalize in a way. We see it differently. We see it from a different perch, and that allows us to respond in a very different way. And so I'm hoping I'm decent at it. It was a big part of my research to really think with people what happens when we're able to reframe, right? You know, it's the reframe is one of those words that we use a lot in society. And the way I think about it is, it's if you and I went outside to the street dinner and I said, okay, I'm going to ask you to draw this skyscraper right in front of me. And then when you finish, I said, okay, come with me. And we go across the street and we go up in the elevator of an adjacent building. We go on the roof and I say, okay, Dana, now I want you to draw that same skyscraper, right? But it looks entirely different, right? And I think that is the one of the very important requirements for navigating growth in adult life is being able to reframe emotions. It isn't necessarily just recognizing how we feel and what, you know, and the derivatives of, you know, we might feel fear and then therefore we feel self-doubt and we get aggressive towards ourselves. Those are all wonderful things. But, you know, my hope is that the work I do, the work you do and others is that we can get people to really move through that to another place where they can experience those emotions in a different way and find some real power in it. Because if we can release the emotions' power over us, we kind of let some more sunlight in or oxygen in. And it's amazing how instructive our emotions can be, right? They can really help us connect to meaning that we might not have seen before. And I think that that's a place that's very promising. I mean, that we haven't done a lot of work in yet. And I think that that's, you know, that's something that's an opportunity.
I'm not a research person. I'm a clinical person in what I do. How does one research the concept of disruption and help people manage it? What was the process that you went through? Were you affiliated with the university, or was it private?
Yeah, In the beginning, I was not. In the beginning, as I mentioned, I started with this outplacement firm. And so the beginning flights of the research were all either one-on-one or focus group interviews, right, that were, you know, biographical in nature. I would have a standard set of questions that I went through, and all of them were audio taped, so I could go back and listen to the, you know, kind of the cues that were coming out. And so there were nearly 300 people that participated through that phase of the research. So that was a lot of data points. And then I took 80 of those folks who agreed to work through a series of what I call exercises, right, which were really based on the findings of the research to pressure test some of the key points that I heard repetitively, and to make sure I understood how they were responding in their own experience. And so 80 of those people participate in multi-session events. Some of them are online, some of them are in person, but testing all these exercises, many of which are now in the book, because every one of the 10 chapters of the book features an exercise that was kind of interrogated by this group of 80. And so those were the original sets of research. And then after those initial flights have happened, now I've gone on to partner with organizations and universities. And there's a university in Boston, Simmons University, that is just about to publish my latest research, which is on the impact of COVID-19 on career aspirations, which is really interesting, right? That, you know, we found that we surveyed nearly 500 working adults and found that even though before the pandemic they thought their kind of career and their path was set, the majority of them made a switch in their aspirations during the pandemic. And so we looked at why did that happen?
Well, I'm not sure exactly even what that means. What does a change in your aspiration mean on a career level?
Yeah, well, so an aspiration is kind of a dream or a reasoning what meaning we ascribe to the work we do, right? You know, for some it's a paycheck every other Friday. For others, it's because they want to make an impact on the world or do something. You know, there's some, it holds meaning for everyone, and there's no judgment as to the meaning yours holds versus mine. No, but the fact that meaning exists is really the thing we were exploring, and we asked if that meaning shifted through the pandemic.
And did it shift in sort of positive or negative ways, or is
it? And it's interesting, it shifted in meaningful ways in that people reported a moderate to large shift in their thinking about what it was that their career was all about, and there were many who responded with a mix, both positive and negative, right? That, you know, it you know, might have been unexpected and had some positive threads, but others that, you know, were less so. So that research is just an illustration of what has been a series of inquiries that I have been involved in over the last decade, but all around this notion of how do we grow as adults, and how does disruption play a part in that?
You know, it's interesting that you describe it this way, because I think that one of the main impacts that I saw that COVID had was to scare everybody. It introduced a whole nother level of fear into our world, in that for men like me and people in my generation, if we're old school, which I am, our job is to keep our families safe. And when you have an invisible foe that can kill you or your family, it creates a kind of anxiety that has never been present in my lifetime, because most of the foes that we face are recognizable, but you can't recognize a virus. And we were so, the media fueled the fear on such a deep level that I can't tell you how many people between the ages of, how many men, especially between the ages of maybe 50 and 70, found their way into my office because they felt so helpless and ineffective in their role as protectors of their family. And that's just one small example. I also know that lots of marriages came to an end, because the reason the marriages worked so well is because the people never really saw each other, except maybe at the end of a couple hours. And so they didn't really know each other very well. And then all of a sudden they were stuck with each other and realized that they didn't really like each other very much.
And I don't mean to chuckle, but I completely understand.
But the other side of it is that some people actually fell more in love with their partners when they finally got a chance to spend time with them. But really, the problem in these situations that involve change, big change, is that for some reason, as human beings, we don't like change, even if it's positive. It's a very frightening concept. And it oftentimes brings out the worst in us because it brings out aggression in big time. I mean, I have a friend who's he manages emergency room physicians. He said that during COVID, the homeless and indigent populations stopped showing up at the emergency room because they were afraid that they would get COVID. And that was their only source of medical care. But the emergency rooms were filled with drunk driving accidents and domestic and sexual abuse victims. And it was off the Richter scale how it brought out the worst in most people. So I'm bringing this up, not to cast a negative light on what we're talking about, but your work is all about how do people deal with the intense fear of having their lives disrupted in a major way.
Yes, and I think that your examples are so powerful. Thank you for sharing them. I think this notion of, our lack of literacy or fluency of big change is a real problem, as we've just seen, right? It's so present everywhere because of, the pandemic and what we saw in the examples that you just said. I have to tell you that I found through my work that education is power here, right? That if we can educate people on how to place their fear in a broader context of the change, that all of a sudden their fear dissipates, right? It doesn't go away, right? But it allows it to change. And that's the first thing, right? I often describe, there's a technique in the book that we use or that I use often in my work. It's called HAIL. And it's a mnemonic that stands for a four-step emotional reframing technique. It's HAIL. And I often describe it in this way. It takes an experience and an emotion like fear, right? And mostly when fear is active, it's like hanging on the end of a rope, and the rope is in power and it can, whip us around willy-nilly. It changes direction. Ooh, we just hang on for dear life, right? But if we educate people and give them techniques on how, to your point, to respond differently, it is as if we're able to drop that rope on the ground next to us, right? Fear doesn't go away. I can still see it on the ground, right? But it does not have the power to just whip me around and I have to hang on for dear life. And I think that that is the reason that I'm so passionate about this work, that I have seen it work time and again, that if we give people the tools to respond differently, all of a sudden we're having a different conversation. And that is important, right? Because look, when we don't, we have domestic violence rates increasing in ERs, or we have, we have all sorts of ills of every flavor that accelerate. Because by the way, even though the pandemic, we can all argue, is maybe over, the period of disruption is not, right? We are going to have persistent disruption in our life. We can use the topic of AI right away, okay? I like to talk about it as AI musical chairs, if you're still in the working world, right? AI is fantastic. It has enormous capacity, right? This ability to use generative AI to do new thing, right? Great. But what happens when it takes out 20% of the working roles that we have that currently employ people today, right? Those people are going to have enormous disruption, right? And I say that as an illustration of there is just disruption consistently in our society. We're in a period of rapid change. And so my work is really about changing the conversation about that big change and saying there's a way to think about it. If we look at actually what's happening and adopt some new tools like the practice that you're in on how to respond differently, we can have a different experience with major change. Because if we can, right, all of a sudden, if we adopt these things, we can withstand body blows and not get knocked over. And I think that's the goal, right? The goal is to get everybody to a point where they can withstand greater and greater moments of disruption and not be knocked over. Keep going.
Do you feel like there's a spiritual component to what it is that you're proposing? Because you speak about it in very scientific terms, which is good, but I'm just sort of curious, and you may not have one, and that's okay, but I'm just kind of curious if you see that as part of the way of managing fear?
I will tell you that in a number of the people that participated in my research, a spiritual awakening was very much a part of their experience, right? Oh. I'm not going to say that it was common. It wasn't everywhere, but it was present enough that you could see it, that for some, spirituality played an enormous role in their ability to connect with their truth or their essence, right? But there are others for whom that was absent, right? And so I think really, you know, as I've understood what's happening in growth, right, is that when we enter adulthood, we define our expectation and definition for who we are based on our external environment, right? That includes, you know, our families, our religious affiliations, the occupations we choose, our education, the communities we live in, right? We kind of create this amalgam of definition and expectation for who we are based on that. Right. And that as we encounter disruptions serially over our lives, what I now understand is those are kind of invitations to re-examine those assumptions. And when we choose to, right, when we choose to engage, what we do is we re-examine what holds value and meaning to us, and we change out those things. We say, oh, you know what? Yeah, that used to be really important to me, but doesn't hold water anymore. Oop, that one's gone. And so this notion of understanding that and calling into activity, like creating a place for what holds value, meaning to us, to come forward, gives us this greater and greater stability to withstand uncertainty and disruption. And for many, there is a spiritual component to that. Not all.
I'm not necessarily referring to religion, because for a lot of people like me, I was forced to participate against my will. And so the last thing in the world that you would ever find me doing is walking into a temple to celebrate my spirituality, because all that did was represent my not being able to be on the baseball field or in the ocean surfing. So, in those days, if there was such a thing as God, it was in the ocean or on the baseball field and had nothing to do with, you know, all the formality of all that stuff. But part of what I do with people now is to help them recognize that there is a bit of a psychological danger in being externally centered in your life. And so I try to encourage people not to be self-centered, because that's very obnoxious, but to be centered within yourself. Because the more that you're able to connect with your intuition and your that inner voice, the easier it is to manage the difficulties that life has to offer everyone. Nobody gets a life without pain. I mean, that's not a reality. And disruption is a huge part of all of our lives at some stage, sometimes for some people more than others. But I try to help people recognize that a lot of the answers that they're looking for are going to come from the deep feelings that they have inside. And I wasn't sure whether that was part of what you encourage people to do in your work.
100%. Okay. 100%. Right. Okay. 100%. Yes, that this voice that I'm talking about is really, you know, being able to connect with that voice,
right?
You know, that intuition, as you use that word, and then being willing to act on it, right? This will be interesting perhaps for your listeners. I remember I did this big forum up in Chicago, and it was about this, right? You know, how we connect to our voice, recognizing when we need to and what it offers if we do. And right after, two women ran up to me, and one woman was in tears. And she said, you know, I can hear my voice. It's screaming at me. But the consequences of acting in alignment with that voice were terrifying, for her, right? Now, the other woman standing right next to her put her hand above her eyebrows and pretended she was like a seafarer, like looking for a distant land. And she's like, I haven't seen my voice in 30 years, right? And so I just, you know, I love that story because it recognizes that this notion of connecting with our intuition, I'll use your word, it isn't binary, like I have it, I don't, right? It is a process of awareness. And first we need to come into recognizing that we have this voice. And then we have to choose to act in alignment with it. And those are iterative steps, right? That isn't one swing of the bat, like you're on the, you know, the field when you're a little kid. It is really 1,000 steps. And in my work, it is really about really recognizing that there is such enormous power. And I don't mean like beat your chest power. There's this beauty to really igniting that intuition and giving it room to be present in your life. And with that, you can withstand almost any profile of disruption and keep going instead of being knocked down.
You and I are sure on the same page as far as this.
Yeah, we sure do.
People always, again, the word God is kind of a loaded term for a lot of people. But people have often said to me, you know, I pray, but I never get any response. And my response to that is, well, do you have an intuition? And they say, yeah, but I, you know, I don't trust it very much, or it's hard for me to believe it, or sometimes I can't tell the difference between being afraid and what my intuition is telling me. And what I ask people to consider is that, and this is just Dana's view of the world, but I think that the way that one of the ways that God speaks to us is through our intuition. And so if we're willing to look at it with the kind of sacred devotion that that we could, if we decide, that eventually it becomes much easier the more you learn to trust it, but it does not make your life easier. Because the more you listen, the harder your life becomes, because then, as you are shaking your head, absolutely, you're faced with choices that you could easily talk yourself out of if you don't listen to what your body's trying to tell you.
Oh, Dana, I can't tell you the days when I just say, can't you just go get a regular job? Like, just go get a job.
Exactly.
Right? Why do you do such hard work, right? This, why do you have to make it so hard all the time? Like, just go get a job. Come on. Like, you know, so I'm completely, that's why I'm shaking my head. Yes, of course. I understand exactly what you say. And it is not an easy road. It's a fulfilling road. It's a road that fuels my soul in ways. So I guess it is spiritual in some way. But it is by no means easy, but it is, it is my choice.
Well, I think that what you're asking people to consider in making the changes they do in their life is probably one of the bravest things that a person could do, which is to take themselves seriously and not to rationalize things away that are troublesome and cause despair and loneliness and frustration. Again, I don't know you well enough to know that what happened to you when you were sitting in that that meeting, but I'm assuming that you had a really strong feeling like, I don't belong here. This is not my home, my business home, or my whatever home you want to call it. And how are you supposed to trust that feeling and not try to talk yourself out of it, right? You could have easily said, oh, I'm just tired, or, you know, why am I making such a big deal about this? I should be so happy. I finally reached the pinnacle of my desired career and all of that. But somehow you found the courage to listen to what your insides were telling you. And then if you think about where it's led you, which is to a very deeply personal feeling of being of service in a much different way than you were when you were working with, you know, in the corporate world, you're actually in the process, hopefully, and I believe it, that you're changing people's lives on a very individual level in the work that you're doing. And I just said, well, the reason, one of the main reasons I wanted you to come here is because I wanted to give you credit for switching up your life in such a dramatic way and really listening to one of your main purposes in your life, which is, in my opinion, to show the world what Linda's version of love looks like.
Because really,
you're just showing the world what your version of life looks like, which is a powerful thing, in my opinion.
Well, I appreciate you giving me that recognition, because I think that every day is hard and every day is a choice. And I still have to choose again and again to do this. And I think that in that staff meeting, while I was terrified, there was a voice inside that says there's something more.
Right.
And I had to trust that. And in order to try to communicate the humility that I had to walk through to get that in the book that I've just written, Dancing with Disruption, in every one of the 10 chapters, there are stories of all the people from my research, but my story goes all the way through, right? I'm the only story that's in all 10 chapters. And I really bring people to the moments of pain and uncertainty and doubt and joy. And I think that, you know, this trusting ourselves and having the courage to try, is really fascinating. And what I believed the issue was when I was sat in that staff meeting, you know, I'm not going to do a spoiler alert, but the issue was very different from what the ultimate issue was that was really trying to get my attention. And I disclose that in the book as we go forward, but it took me steps. I had to take steps before I really understood what was happening. And right. I think that, you know, the work that you do, the work that I do, it is all about trying to create a platform for others to have the courage to take that step, that next step. And right. I think that it is a really enlivening and joyful experience for those who trust themselves. And the beautiful thing is you can design it in such a way that any one step can minimize risk. It's not like it's reckless. I'm going to go bet the farm. There's ways to do it in a measured fashion so that you begin to step into your joy, your power, in a way that isn't going to, you know, disrupt your responsibilities and other things you have. There is a way to do it. And so that's part of the reason why I do my work, because I think we misunderstand that. And if we could help people understand it, the activity of all those voices is enough to change our world. Sure. And I live in the world that says we need everyone's voice at the table.
Absolutely. Do your kids know you in this way?
Oh, for sure. My children are now, we're 10 years into it. My children are now, one just graduated from high school, you know, and my kids are bigger now, right? And yes, they do.
But they're willing to listen. That's why I'm asking that question, because
you
could help your kids enormously if they would listen.
I guess I can't answer that one in any honest fashion other than to say I'm a parent of teenagers. And I'm not sure they listen, but I think they observe. I think they see. And how much they see will play out in the next, you know, 20 to 50 years for them.
Well, my kids are in their late 30s, and occasionally I wonder if they listen to anything I ever said. And then other times I think, wow, they really did listen. So,
that's beautiful. Aren't they lucky?
Lives. So we have about 5 or so minutes left, and I'm just kind of curious about what else you might want to impart my audience with.
You know, there was this beautiful story, and I think that the power of my work is really telling stories that other people can listen to and see themselves in, right? You know, there was this one woman, Lakshmi, who participated in my research, and she was in her mid-30s, and she ultimately came in and said, you know, I was overwhelmed by what happened. This was a crushing moment, she said, because I realized that I didn't want to be the person that I had spent nearly 15 years becoming. You know, she had been somebody who was in this very fancy MD PhD program, and she was this big researcher. And she said, you know, I never even dreamed outside of being this person, right? You know, ever since I was a little kid, this was who I was going to be. And she said, it was terrifying, first of all, to realize it and then to act on it. And it didn't really even come to her, you know, as all of a sudden, voila, you know, oh, I don't want to be this person. She said, you know, she was somebody who was physically very, very fit. And she had this period of debilitating headaches. Like she just got these enormously disruptive moments where she couldn't work. She had to stay out of, you know, it was difficult. And she said, you know, I kept saying to myself, what does my body know that I don't know yet? And she ultimately came, right? You know, I mean, so somebody who had such physical, you know, self-awareness is, you know, is meaningful. But she ultimately came to this realization that she described as crushing. She's like, I realized that this isn't who I want to be, that there's this environment. I don't like the behavior of the people. I don't like what I'm doing. And everything I envisioned it to be was wrong. And it took an enormous amount of pain for her to finally make a choice. And her first choice was to take a leave of absence, right? It gave her some runway to step away from what was an instigator of her physical pain. And she got, you know, some employment. She got a kind of a part-time teaching position in a local school. And ultimately, there were many, many other steps she took. But at the end, she said, you know, the stunning thing here is that I've now learned people tell me that I'm funny and that I'm a good leader. And she said, you don't understand how truly astonishing that is to me, because it is so far away from the person I was trying to be. And I was stifling, you know, these very natural abilities that I have because I didn't believe they were what was valued in the environment I was in. And it took this radical amount of pain and this series of choices for her to get to this place where she had an experience that I believe is common to everyone's experience, which is we meet ourselves through our interactions with others, right? This ability to be with others and to be reflected back and to try things, try out her voice in that community was enormously powerful. And it ultimately led her to many great steps. And if you're super interested, you can go to your local library and get my book. But she, you know, she had this transformative experience and from a place of terrifying fear. And I think that that is the cycle, Dana, that I've witnessed again and again and again. And that's why I'm so motivated to do this work, because I think in the normal course, many of us would get to that point of debilitating headaches and maybe some recognition of uncertainty of where we're in the right place. And we would either stall, disengage, or retreat, right? We would double down or we would kind of go on a loop, but we wouldn't say, okay, I need to make a radical change. And that's what I hope your listeners hear, that for those who are willing to entertain radical change, and again, it's not reckless. There's nothing reckless about it. There is kind of a very measured way to go into that type of change. There is really great goodness available. And it isn't just for the few. It isn't just, you know, over every one in 10, you get a Lakshmi. You get it for everybody who's willing to do that. And this notion, you know, I see, maybe because I was in the corporate world for so long, but I see so many people disengaging or stalling that I find it heartbreaking. And I think that that's really the thing, you know, the sisters taught me long ago, right? That a life well lived is in service to others. And that's really my work. My work is really educating so that people understand this. So it's not fearful, right? That the fear can go away a bit. We can never get rid of it 100%, but we can dissipate. We can, you know, let out the air, the fear a little bit and take a step and then take another step. And you know, people like Lakshmi were incredibly generous to walk next to me and share their story. But she in one of her final interviews with me said something that you would love. She said, you know, our inner voice is our most profound teacher.
I'll tell you.
And I was like, my goodness, she's right. Isn't she right? And you know, her story, you know, there's a lot more to her story, but it ends my book. And it is something that we need to choose. And this will be the last theme that I hope your reader or your listeners will think about. Many, many times in life, we are forced to make a change, right? You know, we have a spouse that dies. We're all of a sudden forced to be a single person. We lose a job. We have an illness, right? We're forced to make a change. We will never grow in the way that I've described in the last hour unless we actively choose, right? Mm-hmm. Lakshmi could never be forced into recognizing the power of her voice. For that, she had to actively choose. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the first things that I cover in the book and in my work is that we are so accustomed to not choosing. We really are in life, right? And so the first thing is we have to get kind of more of awareness about how we choose, what our behaviors are with respect to choosing, actively choosing, not letting the circumstances define what it is we're going to do, but our taking the choice. And ultimately, it really centers on our voices, right? Ultimately, the gift of these disruptions and responding in the way we've been talking about is this connection to what you call intuition, what I call voice, and that we're turning up the volume on our own voices. And we have, you know, in that the ability to change the world. And I think the world desperately needs all of our voices. So, you know, I can't thank you enough, Dana, for letting me talk about at least my little slice into it.
So before I let you go, please tell us the name of your book again.
The book is called Dancing with Disruption.
And what's the best way for people to find your book?
They can find it anywhere they buy books, right? On Amazon or Barnes & Noble or other independent booksellers online. It also is available through many public libraries.
Oh, okay. And if anybody would like to reach out to you specifically, are you open to people that might have questions or?
Absolutely. I'd love to hear from people. For those who would like, it's easy to get to me in two ways. One is through LinkedIn, right? It's easy to get to me if you're somebody who has access to LinkedIn. The other is through my website, which is lindarosetti.com. There's an easy way to fill out a form there and email will come right to me. The only tricky part of it is I have a difficult last name, right? Linda is L-I-N-D-A, but right. My last name is spelled with two S's and two T's. So if we were in Italy, they would tell me that I mispronounce it. but it is R-O-S-S-E-T-T-I, so Linda Rossetti.
Very good. Well, thank you so much again. You're very inspiring, it was really fun to have this conversation with you.
I had a great time, Dana. Thank you for having me, and congratulations on all the great work that you do.
Well, thanks.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.